This episode was recorded in July 2020. If you enjoy this podcast, then subscribe to catch all future episodes.
Paul McVeigh, how are you?
Well, no messing around this morning.
I tell you what, you've got me, it's the earliest you've got me up in this lockdown. What are you doing?
Good, because I've been up from 6 o'clock this morning. So
when I saw my phone this morning, Paul McVeigh, what time's that? I was thinking, oh God, he's been chatting to someone, or what's been going? What have you been up to lockdown anyway? What's it been like for you? Is it curtailed stuff, or have you still been busy?
Honestly, Rob, I think it's probably the busiest I've ever been in my life. It's crazy. Uh-huh. I think it almost seems like there's this dichotomy where you either have watched every Netflix show you've ever wanted to watch in your life, or you've just been as busy as you've ever been and done 100 Zoom calls a day, and you just, there's not enough hours in the day for some people. So don't know which category you've fitted into, but I'm definitely down this end of the spectrum, and you know, barely know my head from the tail at the moment.
It's been, to be fair, I say it's been nice. I mean, I'm at the bored end of nice now, because I want to go out, but the kids have been round and all that kind of thing, and we've been doing the Zoom calls, which has actually allowed me to chat to people I've not chatted to in ages, which has been decent. I've seen have you been doing podcasts as well as your keynote speaking stuff?
Done a bit of everything, to be honest. It sort of started off where, you know, because my stuff is face-to-face, all my, you know, the keynote speaking I'm doing around the world would always be going to the company, going to the event, and standing, you know, in front of 100, 200, 500 people. But then, of course, from January time, they were already starting to get cancelled, so I probably get hit a little bit earlier than most. And then from doing that, it then went through a couple of months of people thinking, I'm not sure what to do. Everyone has this uncertainty, which is never good for anybody. And then it was almost like a bit of a turnaround and a 180, where companies were starting to think, well, actually, during lockdown, we still need to help our people, still need to work with people. So started then doing sessions online, because there's people, like speaking to a friend who's at Goldman Sachs in Hong Kong, and he's saying, you know, similar to London, you have a whole lot of 20, 30 something working there who, you know, generally their job takes up a large part of their life. They're going most of the days through to the job, then they go out with their friends, they either eat, they socialize, they exercise, generally living by themselves. But of course, once lockdown kicked in, that's really tough for a lot of people, you know, to be by themselves and not have that interaction. So I started doing a lot of sessions for companies around the world to be able to help their staff, you know, deal with these challenges, obviously, because no one's faced it before. And really fortunate to do my keynote for Microsoft, which was, you know, a bit of a big deal for me, because having done this for 10 years, it's, you know, that's probably the pinnacle of what I've done so far in that time. But then the other side of that is going off, and I didn't really feel like I was contributing anything. You know, I kind of was socially distancing, I was sitting at home, but still felt a bit, I'm not doing anything of note. And so I started just doing a few interviews with about 20, 25 kind of, you know, what you would consider pretty successful people, whether it's world champions, you know, senior leaders in business, and just to try and find out this, you know, why they think they're successful. Because I, Rob, you know me, I love this whole area of mindset and psychology of why people are doing what they're doing, how they've got to those heights versus all the people they try and fail.
Can I just, it's fascinating, and we'll talk about that in just a second. The Microsoft I saw, and you say it's a pinnacle. How does it compare when you say you score at Old Trafford? How does it compare, or can you compare? Hey, I've scored at Old Trafford, but I've actually just done a huge business leading project with Microsoft Asia. Yeah. Can you compare the two?
I think you can definitely compare them. It's obviously scoring in the Premier, like, you know, I only scored 2 Premier League goals. So I was, I don't know, on one side, I was fortunate to ever get to the Premier League and made my debut with Spurs. Up front with Teddy Sheringham in 97, and fortunate to score my home debut. But then, you know, we waited nearly another 10 years before I got my second and last Premier League goal. And so I suppose scoring against Old Trafford, you're like, yeah, that's amazing to do that. But I don't know, it kind of felt like it meant more doing the Microsoft gig, because the football has always been so, you know, instrumental in my life, and it's given me so many things. The fact that we're having this conversation has all come from a footballing background. But coming out of football, you know, so many, you know, a lot of ex-players, you know, so many people struggle with it. And the fact that I've kind of come, I decided to retire. I decided to go down this route of keynote speaking just because I never saw any other keynote speakers from the world of football when I started this 10 years ago. And even now, I'm still, you know, struggling to find anyone else who's doing it, or at least doing it full time. And so for me, it was such a big project, and it was a bit like starting back in those youth team days at Spurs. Can I get to the Premier League? Can I get to international football? And when I did my first gig for Aviva 10 years ago, it was like, wow, this is really hard, really tough. Like, you know, whenever you're delivering, you know, or presenting a program in front of TV, like the way you make it so effortless, we know it's all the years, but it's all the years of practice, effort, learning, mistakes to get to that point. So my first time doing a keynote for Aviva 10 years ago was, oh, it was just the pain, the struggle. You know, these rosy red cheeks were just, oh, going so blush. And obviously 10 years later, to get to Microsoft where I feel more competent, capable, have a lot more to offer, it just kind of felt like it meant more.
Do you get nervous doing it? Do you get an extra buzz for doing a Microsoft, if you like?
No, it's the complete opposite now, because, you know, whenever we met in Doha in 2016 during the Euros, you know, I loved working in the media. It was a good fun, and it was also at the same time working as a sports psychologist. At that stage, I was in, I think, my fourth year with Crystal Palace, and I did really enjoy it because it's all part of my life, and I loved that, and loved the variety. But actually, it was once I finished my master's in 2017, and once I finished that in psychology, I realized that the speaking is like my passion. It's the thing that I love the most. So there's absolutely no nerves. It's just, I love being able to share, you know, these insights and kind of these experiences that I've had from that, you know, elite performance world of football.
Do people say on a Microsoft Asia call, excuse me, do they throw you? Can they chuck in a curveball to you that you think, blimey heck, I don't know that? Or is it not as direct as that? Is it something you go away and think about, oh, that's an interesting thought, I'll work on that?
Well, I would say I've definitely thrown a few curveballs over the years and definitely had a few, you know, things to ponder. But when I say it was the best gig of my life and the worst gig of my life, I'll tell you why. It was such a paradox because, you know, speaking for Microsoft, you're like, you know, it's either Facebook, Amazon, Google, you know, Microsoft, that's probably as good as you can get. But whenever I said there were 150 people all on mute, all with their video off. So whenever you deliver, when you deliver your best line and there's absolutely no feedback and there's silence, well, you must know what that's like. You know, it must happen to you all the time.
Brilliant. Oh, funny. Hey, listen, What did you learn about the successful business people and sporting people that made them more successful? Was there a common denominator?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. So as much as, you know, I did my master's, I would never recommend it because I hated it. I'm not an academic. You know, I left school at 16, did my degrees, distance learning at 27, then did my master's distance learning. So I'm not an academic. But I suppose one of the things that does help you understand is this kind of, you know, accumulating all this knowledge and then trying to just siphon out the actual really important key lessons from it. And the funny thing is about asking, you know, people like Carl Frampton, you know, 2-weight world championship boxer, people who have been at the top of their profession, business or the arts or media, whoever it was, a lot of people don't know how they've done it. And it's really interesting because it's my world and because I'm always thinking about how people do things and human behavior and how the way we function, it's almost just something that's so, you know, natural for me to think and ask that question. But people who that's not their world, they don't study psychology, they haven't written a book about it, they don't speak about it, it's like, so why did you do that? And it's probably comparable to why a top-class international footballer doesn't make a top-class international coach or manager, because the difference is how do you take what you know and then explain that to someone else? And whenever I ask them to explain to me why they've done it, very, very few of them out of the 25 of them could actually say, I had this goal, I had this real clarity, I was focused on this, I took this kind of approach, I was flexible in how what I did, I was then resilient, you know, and given be able to break it down, whereas most of them are a bit like, I just kind of was working hard and, you know, it's so vague and generic that you think, well, actually, it's interesting how people who've got to the top of their profession have just done it because they're focused on it. without actually understanding the steps and the methodology behind it.
I'm interested, somebody like Carl Frampton, or I was just wondering, even the business leaders, do they have psychologists, sports psychologists, that they can bounce stuff off? It seems to me that the next logical progression.
Some do, some don't. It was interesting what Carl said about it, that he said in boxing, probably maybe in football, might be the same kind of attitudes or belief system, that if in boxing, if you have a sports psychologist, you're still seen as weak. And that's obviously so old school. That's like, you know, football in the 70s or 80s. But then the reason, probably one of the reasons why I left the world of sports psychology from my sport of football, I just thought that it still wasn't given the kind of the value and the priority that needed. So out of a week of training, you know, you probably would do 95% of your time, you know, physical, technical, tactical. So basically on the pitch or in the gym. And then the other 5% of the time would be a little bit of analysis, a little bit of nutrition, and a little bit of psychology. But whenever you break it down, especially because I've been kind of working in this area for so long, when you break it down, understand what is the differential between this kind of performance and this performance, it's normally this. And if you think, well, if it's all around your mentality and psychology, and you're doing less than 5% of your week working on that, it seems to be an imbalance that probably isn't something that I was particularly happy with. So I thought, listen, if it's not being valued in the football world or in the sports world, probably some sports more than others, I know when I go to the business world or the corporate world, they love it, because it's a bit like it's their desire to learn, it's their desire to improve. And whether that's because of it's a personal growth or whether it's just because we earn more money whenever we improve and grow, it doesn't really matter what the motivating factor is. The business community just seem to absolutely love it because they seem to take it, run with it, and apply it to their business. So ultimately they're benefiting from it.
You see, I'm fascinated by it because I've had more drunken nights than I care to remember with Big Sam Allardyce over in the Middle East, where you know, he goes back to Tampa Bay Rowdies he played for in the late 70s, where, you know, Sam says we've only explored 1% of the mind. And, you know, I tell you what, you'd love speaking to him about it, because, you know, his view of what makes a good sportsman to an absolute top class is the mind. You know, and in most sports, I don't know whether it's comparable with mental strength or it's expanding your mind. But, you know, he values it, what you were doing, sports psychology, would say, with Palace, more than anything else.
Absolutely. And I was actually there whenever Sam was manager at Crystal Palace. So, like, I know, and you only have to look back at all his time in Bolton. The reason why he was probably so successful at Bolton, because he was doing different things. Now, of course, he had some good players in there, but he had some outstanding players who were at the end of their career, not at the prime. Do you know what I mean? So you're thinking, well, he can take a team that didn't have the best possible players, but he put the structure and framework around them. And I remember going to Bolton in the kind of early 2000s, late 90s, and Sam had nearly more support staff than he had players. And that was unheard of, because a couple of years beforehand, whenever I was at Tottenham Hotspur, whenever I first joined in 94, we had a physio and a coach. That was it. And he progressed that all the way through. By 2000, Sam pretty much had 20 to 25 support staff. Go through to whenever I left Crystal Palace in 2017. There were even like 3 strength and conditioning coaches for the academy. You know what I mean? So you just think about that across the entire club. So yeah, he's way ahead of his field and still doing things that most clubs generally don't implement maybe as well as they could. Because I don't know the statistics, but if you were to ask how many, not just Premier League clubs, because obviously they have more budget, but across the entire footballing pyramid, how many professional football clubs have full-time sports psychologists? I bet you'd find it is a very, very small number.
To get golfers, I mean, I one of my questions I was going to ask you is to get to the very top, maybe just not talking about football so much, but to get to the very top, especially maybe in an individual sport, do you need to have a sports psychologist these days?
I don't think you need to have it, because there are plenty of people who probably got to the top of their profession without having it. I think it's gone back to what you just brought up earlier about the capacity and the potential we have in our minds of, if you're performing to that level and you're not using a sports psychologist, imagine once you started exploring it and adding that into your level of performance, it can only go up and up. It's a bit like whenever Arsene Wenger, you know, found out about Tony Adams and whenever he was, you know, doing all his drinking when, in his kind of early days at Arsenal. And then, of course, he got sober and you're thinking, what a player. Imagine if he was sober throughout his entire career, what a player he could have been. And I suppose it's just like, you can never know. That's the difficult answer. You can never know in terms of hypotheticals, but I would, without guaranteeing, I would say it's 99% probability that if you start improving, implementing things that are going to help you get a much more healthy, constructive mindset, you're going to improve your performance.
Here's one that was on Twitter the other day. A couple of journalists, I don't get classed as a journalist because I didn't come through the newspaper ranks. And they were saying journalists should be the ones that do all the interviews with sports people. It was sport we were talking about. Do you think somebody like you, who's been through it, can interview better because you understand the person? I think what they were saying was maybe the sports person is a little bit afraid to ask the key question. I think that's what they were intimating anyway.
I think it is interesting and maybe why, you know, I was working with, you know, like the Sky Sports and BN Sports and BT Sport and stuff when I was doing my media work, because it's just having an understanding and an insight into those kind of, and you don't have to be, you know, don't have to have that experience in a change room to be able to ask the question. And I think it's interesting because that brings me back to whenever I was in probably in my early 20s, mid-20s, and I remember reading a couple of articles about me, and it really just completely turned me off the media. And I was thinking, people are writing things about me that, you know, aren't true. You know, I've never said it, I've never done that, but because that one person is doing it. And the way that I used to think about it, almost as a young, naive man trying to make my way in the game, was, well, why should I listen to this journalist when, let's be honest, he's just good at English, or she's just good at English? Because that's what a lot of journalists, just because they're really good at, you know, being able to write a story. But that doesn't mean they're an expert in football. That doesn't mean they're an expert in sport or business or whatever they're covering. But actually, now I'm obviously much more mature. I have a sort of probably a broader picture of the world. They don't have to understand it, because a journalist isn't writing the answers. He's just asking the questions. And of course, there are some amazing journalists out there, and I've worked with so many of them in the last kind of 10 years working in the media, whether it's in the print media or in the broadcast media. Whenever their understanding of what it takes, even if they haven't done it, is still so incredibly insightful. So yeah, I think both can do it, but probably just might approach it from a different angle.
What are you doing next? What's your next project? You've always got a sneaky little project on the go, apart from talking to Microsoft Asia and whatever. What's the next step for you in this career?
Well, it's interesting because I've been doing the keynote speaking stuff for 10 years now, and I love it. I think I'm going to do it for another 10 years, so that's probably still going to go. So my goal is to be speaking in 50 countries in the next 2 years. So at the minute, I've spoken in 20 countries around the world, and I want to speak across all continents, in every continent across 50 countries, because that's just the way I'm wired. You know, from when I was 17, I read this book, and it just kind of put me on a different trajectory in life of, you know, what do you want your life to look like? What do you want to create? How do you want to live your life? And it would almost go back to whenever I was 17 and walking into the Spurs physio room, and I would see something like top class players in that room, like Teddy Sheringham and Sol Campbell and Nicky Barmby. But the guy I was going to talk about was Gary Mabbott, our captain. Now, of course, Mabbs had unbelievable career, and he was diabetic, so even to get the games that he played and lift the FA Cup and everything. But when I watched him on the physio table, you know, it took the physio so long just to get him kind of ready to get out onto the training field. And of course, at that stage, even as a 17-year-old, I realised he's still a young man. And I was thinking, I need to be doing things in my career so that when I leave football, if I'm lucky to get to 35 and I got to 32, I want to be injury-free. So just thinking ahead about how I want my life to be is always something that I've been doing since I read this book when I was 17. And so now when I'm 42, I'm thinking, right, I've done keynote speaking for 10 years. I want to speak for another 10 years. So that'll be 20 years and go on to something else. But at the minute, it's now a stage where I feel like I've got the ability to start sharing this with people, to be able to start helping people transition out of sport, out of their business, whatever they're doing, so that they can do what I'm doing. Because everybody has a story to tell, you know. Mm-hmm. Even in this world of whether it's sport, business, or media, we're all storytellers, but what people really struggle with is understanding what the format, what is expected of being a keynote speaker, what actually happens behind it. So when you share that with people, so myself and Leon Lloyd, who's a former England rugby player for Leicester Tigers in England, we are now going to be training people how to become keynote speakers. So that's kind of just about to start. That's a 12-month program. We're starting in the next couple of months. And so that's really exciting, because that's a completely different, you know, path from what I was doing before. And yeah, it's that anything that's in the world of me delivering speaking gigs, hopefully around the world, continue to do that around the world, as well as me helping people, because I got so much help whenever I was coming through football, coming out of football. And the biggest probably impact I had on my transition was a friend of mine called Gavin Drake, who used to be at sports psychologist at Norwich. Pretty much held me by the hand coming out of football and went, do this, try this, why don't you try this, why don't you have a look at this. And this was taking me down this route of corporate training and keynote speaking. And so if I can do that with someone else, then I know how much I appreciate what Gavin did for me to be able to help me transition out of football, and again, just love what I'm doing now, and as you said, probably get even more of a buzz out of doing the Microsoft gigs than scoring a Man United.
Hey, I tell you what, brilliant. Thanks very much. But just to get down to brass tacks, you know what I love? We love you, Paul. If it's quite all right, we love you. You probably play it on your guitar. Hey, what a brilliant song. And, you know, they're still singing it now. It's fantastic, isn't it? What a classic.
Frankie Valli, I love you, baby. It's just like, do you know what? I would like to, you know, in my own kind of like little ego in my head, I'd like to think, oh, they're still singing about me in Carrow Road in 10 years. Even 10 years, 20 years later. Do you know what? It's not. It's because the song is so catchy. Most of them are singing it going, who is this wee Irish dude we keep singing about? They've never seen me play or anything.
It's brilliant, mate. Hey, listen, Paul, lovely, lovely talking to you. Thanks for joining us. We'll follow you with interest, and hopefully I'll catch up with you very soon as well in person.
Absolutely, mate. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Take care.